reacting to external demands or instruction rather than in ways determined by his own interests and energies and power. He says we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. For Humboldt, then, man is born to inquire and create. And when a man or a child chooses to inquire or create out of his own free choice, then he becomes in his own terms an artist rather than a tool of production or a well-trained parent.
Hello, and welcome to the 54th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. It is April 22nd, Thursday, 2010, and this episode is entitled Just a Gorilla Suit, and you should understand why that's the title by the end of the podcast, so don't worry. I'm Douglas Lane, the host of the podcast, and this week's episode features the second half of my conversation with the abstract expressionist painter and UFO researcher, Bud Hopkins. Bud and I discuss his book, his memoir, Art, Life, and UFOs. I'd usually thank the people who donated to the podcast at this point, but as I've stopped taking donations and am instead taking pledges for a Kickstarter campaign, I'll thank people who pledged to that instead. So I want to thank Mahesh R.M., Robert K., Ken B., Will S., Ben B., Jarrett S., Jason R., Mary B.B., Lewis W., and Seth. So thank you all of you. I'll mention the Kickstarter campaign again at the end of the podcast, but that will do for now. I also want to thank everyone who emailed or contacted me via Facebook, and remind you that you can call in to Diet Soap and get your voice on the podcast. That number is 971-285-4604. Again, that's 971-285-4604 to call in to Diet Soap. Right now you're listening to the theme from The Day the Earth Stood Still, the original 1951 movie, and that's being played by the Austin Wind Symphony. I'll provide a link to the YouTube video of the Austin Wind Symphony's performance in the show notes. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to author, painter, and abduction expert Bud Hopkins as we get around to the subject of UFOs. Bud Hopkins, you are a central figure in ufology and abduction research, but you are also a painter and sculptor of note. You are also the founder of the Intruders Foundation, a nonprofit organization which seeks to provide sympathetic help to people who report abduction experiences. You also research the abduction phenomenon and try to educate the public on the subject. Along with your recent memoir, you've written several books, including Missing Time, Intruders, and Witnessed. So, do you have anything you want to add to or correct about that bio?
Of course, there are four books on the UFO subject, the fourth being called Sight Unseen.
I want to talk to you about UFOs. You know, I'm someone who is aware of you primarily first as an abduction researcher and a UFO researcher, and that probably is something that you encounter a lot. How do you handle the fact that your primary interest and passion is painting, but that you're more well known for UFOs?
Well, being better known for that is UFO research is not a surprise, because UFO research and writing books and giving talks, and you appear on television programs and you're interviewed a lot, and some of these programs have millions of people watching, you know, Oprah and Larry King and all these things. And you appear on these things, and so therefore you become known to a huge number of people on some level. And the art world is a tiny, tiny thing. It almost approaches the tininess of poetry. And it weren't that we had some paintings that were selling for a lot of money, and the prices were mentioned in the newspapers and so forth, probably would be fewer people interested in art. But we're really off in a corner, so there's no way that, you know, if you stop people on the street and you say Franz Klein or you mention Damien Hirst, and so they're not going to, the average guy isn't going to know what the hell you're talking about. But you mention Carl Sagan, UFOs, abductions, you know. So that's always been a problem to me. I recently was talking to a collector of mine who said that she was talking to a dealer, and she said, an art dealer, she said, you should go down and see Bud Hopkins' paintings, what he's doing now. And he said he was afraid to go down because he heard of all this crazy stuff that he was mixed up in Hopkins' UFOs. So, I mean, if he actually articulated that, God knows what everybody else is thinking.
Well, there's a politics to all this, because for the world of fine arts is a kind of aristocratic world. You know, this is a world that is invested in by the most powerful and wealthy segments of our society, and it's kind of restricted to those segments, the highly educated, highly moneyed segment. And the UFO phenomenon, the cliche there is that it you know, the saucer lands in a trailer park.
Well, that's the cliche. Since I work with people who have actually been abducted, and the range, of course, is that if I have, say, a psychiatrist to whom this has happened, or a NASA engineer and a guy who lives in a trailer park, I could tell you which one is the only one who would ever make this public. That's
right.
The poor guy in the trailer truck. There's a whole sort of socioeconomic pole, which the higher you go up the pole, the less likely the person would ever report the experience, and therefore the cliche is given birth. But I think what you said about the art world being connected with, you know, the wealthy and so forth, the better educated, the UFO phenomenon is totally democratic. First of all, any kind of person can be involved in a sighting or an experience. And as I said, I've had everything from housewives and plumbers and farmers to cops to NASA engineers, you name it. Doctors, I've had 8 psychiatrists come to me about their own experiences. But the point is the democratic sense of it, because the experience is something that happens accidentally to somebody, I mean, it would seem. And the art thing you have to kind of develop an interest in. But the people I work with have no interest in it except what happened to them, really.
Well, could you just describe what the typical case is like and what your role is with abductees?
Well, usually somebody contacts me because they cannot explain some experience they've had, which is extremely disturbing, and of which they have very vivid recollections of at least part of some incident that might be inexplicable to them. To give you an example, this is not atypical. A couple is driving along the road, and this thing suddenly appears above the car, flies right over the treetops, and their car stops of its own accord. The man and the woman get out of the car. The man's on the driver's side. It's his wife or his girlfriend. They're looking up, and then without any sense of any time elapsing, they find themselves on the same side of the car, over the side of the road. And they're thinking, what happened to that thing, that UFO, or whatever it was, it's gone, didn't see it leave. They don't know how they both got on the same side. The driver doesn't remember going around. And they both feel extremely upset, and they don't know why. And when they go home and the girlfriend takes off her earrings, she finds that the earrings are on backwards, both of them. The posts are coming through from the back. And she has no idea, you know, probably no woman in the world has ever put on both earrings backwards. so she doesn't know what to happen. Whatever. Then ultimately they puzzle because they also lost a couple of hours in the trip home. Maybe the 20-minute drive took 2 hours and 20 minutes or something. So ultimately, what if they run into a book or see me or somebody else on a radio TV thing, whatever, somehow they contact me. And so we begin to discuss what happened, and I am asking questions about what they remember. Ultimately, when I ask questions about, well, has anything like this ever happened to you before, or anything strange when you were a little kid or something, out comes other things. Yeah, that's funny. That time I got lost and I couldn't, I don't remember where, how I got lost. And my parents said I was missing for 3 hours and I called the police, you know, and suddenly there I was at home, you know, et cetera. So not to go on and on here. Ultimately, if I feel they're sufficiently stable and so forth, and I can use hypnosis, which I've learned many years ago, to look into the missing time part of it, the part that they can't remember, and out comes this experience where they were actually abducted. They often figures, strange little gray figures, now so ubiquitous, unfortunately, and they're taken out of the car, and they're where they were standing, into the craft, usually up a beam of light, however that works, however any of this works, we have no idea at all. They're taken in a craft, and there are certain procedures that take place. And this is the part that we have unearthed as time has gone on, because there have been so many cases in different parts of the world, and we always get the same thing, in effect. And there's an interest in the central nervous system and the reproductive system when they're put on tables and examined, and very often samples of flesh are taken, the marks that are left, which we call scoop marks, you know, there's another type of straight line scars. They're just, again, ubiquitous. I reproduce three of the scoop marks in the book just to show the similarities. But at any rate, they're then ultimately put down back on the ground, maybe not in the same place. That's the point. They're mistakes are made. Some people have been put down in the wrong house, but usually the wrong, you know, some sort of simple dislocation like that of the position around the cars. What happens then is that they're left with very often post-traumatic stress disorder, because on some level they're remembering the experience, at least how it shocking it is, but they don't remember the exact details, and that's where I can help. And the process then really becomes a kind of therapeutic process.
So you're both an investigator and a therapist with these.
Well, I call myself a de facto therapist. I've never had any training as a therapist, but as a warm human being, you know, you use common sense, and I think I've been helpful to a number of people.
And people who are truly suffering from post-traumatic stress, you'll send to an actual therapist.
Oh yeah,
right?
Absolutely. The point is that we have not a very extensive list, but we do have some therapists who are very interested in the situation and will work with these people, and these therapists are quite amazed by what's uncovered, what they uncover too when they're working with the people. So I know that in outline form it sounds like something from the National Enquirer and whatnot, but the point is this stuff is going on, and that's why I'm sort of drawn to it, partly for the human sense of trying to help these people, but more profoundly, I suppose, trying to find out what is going on with what is obviously the biggest event in human history.
It does sound like the kind of a tabloid story when you just kind of lay it out, but I'm sure that in your life it has had a much richer and deeper kind of quality to it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to even begin to suggest the intensity of these experiences, and as they're reliving them under hypnosis or just telling me what they remember consciously, because many of these people remember large pieces of the story quite consciously. I've had some that remember the entire thing consciously, as if whatever processes were used by the UFO occupants to make them forget somehow didn't take in some cases. I mean, the sheer emotion of the whole thing and the fact that you can actually help these people is, of course, one of the most rewarding things you can imagine.
You saw your own flying saucer in 1964. That's how your interest in flying saucers or UFOs started. And then over the next half century, you became more and more involved and saw more and more of this phenomenon be exposed. And it must have really changed your approach to life, I would think. It must have changed the way you viewed the universe. Talk a little bit about that, if you can, on kind of that abstract level.
First of all, set the record straight. I had that sighting in 64, and I didn't do anything about it, quote-unquote, until 75. I mean, it took 11 years to shake me loose with another incident, which is so important that in the story, which was not mine, but somebody I knew fairly well. But the thing is, in terms of how this has affected me, you know, it's extremely interesting that the astronauts, every time they came back, I mean, and were interviewed, their whole perspective on everything was changed. Not all of them, but many of them spoke to about the spiritual, emotional, whatever changes of being away from home, so to speak, away from the Earth and seeing the universe in an absolutely firsthand, dramatic way. And I think that for me, there's something a little bit like that. Of course, I haven't been away from Earth, but the point is that you begin to realize that home, as we know it, is really in a far more precarious position than I had thought, because there is actually, on top of global warming and these horrendous wars that started and so forth. But apart from all of that, here you've got this other force out there. And I remember talking to Donald Barthelme one time. This when I had written an article, The Village Force, way back in 76. He said, damn it, but I read your article. And he said, I've got enough problems in my life. I don't need this. He said, I'm really kind of sorry I read it and so forth. So that's a major shift in maybe temporary in this case, but in my life it was a major shift to realize that the world is a far more precarious place that makes me sort of love it more. And one of the basic things that's happened is that in understanding from the outside the behavior of these UFO occupants and their coldness and detached sense and their lack of emotion and lack of the human values that we all have, somehow it's made me appreciate human nature with all of its vagaries and problems and so on infinitely more than if I hadn't seen this as a contrast.
Let's build a sandcastle to the moon. Let's build a sandcastle to the moon. You get the bucket, I'll get the shovel. I'll show you that I'm no Jim Lovell. Let's build a sandcastle to the moon. Let's build a sandcastle to the moon. We'll rain down from above, gazing on our world with love. Let's build a sandcastle to the moon. Let's swim out to Hawaii, build our foundation out of igneous rock. Then we'll raise our tower grain by grain, block by block. Dwell in our steeple of devotion. Our hope will be
Let's build a sandcastle to the moon. You take my heart, I'll take your hand. We'll build an empire out of sand. Let's build a sandcastle to the moon. Yeah, let's build a sandcastle to the moon. Hey, let's build a sandcastle, Dad. Let's build a sandcastle. I wanna let's build a sandcastle to the moon. Honey, let's build a sandcastle. Why don't we let's build a sandcastle? Oh, baby, let's build a sandcastle to the moon.
Yeah, did Bartlemy end up sticking with the UFO phenomena as something he believed in?
I don't know. See, I never really got to know him. It was just a very casual thing, and I dedicated one of my assembled paintings to him because, and I was called them City Paintings because his book City Life.
Well, I've been interested in it for a while myself, and I have this book called The Edge of Reality, which is a series of conversations between Alan Hynek and Jacques Vallée, and they came up with a number of explanations for the UFO phenomenon, and I just wanted to find out where you sat on this spectrum. The first one is the extraterrestrial hypothesis, where they speculate that an alien race is working on the human race, that's conditioning us. Vallée talks about a control system that's directing human social relationships, and that's a very interesting version of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but in general, it's just, you know, these are aliens from another planet or creatures from another planet. That's the first one. The second one is they speculate that maybe the UFO phenomenon could be a secret weapon program, some sort of government conspiracy.
Well, that is absolutely ridiculous. It's so, you know, because it's been going on in the 20th century. I mean, Calvin Coolidge had it as a secret weapon. A little hard to believe.
Okay, all right. And then the third one is that maybe UFOs are really psychic projections, that these are events that are projected out of our own minds. And I'm reminded of the film Forbidden Planet. Have you ever seen that, where the monsters come from the id and they come to life in that movie? But that's the third possibility. And then the final one is that they suggest that this could be a phenomenon that exposes a reality of multiple universes or some other level to reality that we're not aware of.
Yeah, well, that's the one that has been posited as the catch-all basket because people don't like the other ones. Just almost impossible to even say what you mean when you talk about that. There was a wonderful, terrible remark that a UFO investigator said, he probably regretted, but he committed to writing, where he said he did not believe UFO occupants were extraterrestrial because they're not doing what extraterrestrials would do, which I thought was one of the most bizarre remarks anybody could make. So I'm up there with the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but you know there's so many the time traveler thing and all sorts of theories. But the point about this is that about the phenomenon which makes it a problem for a lot of people is that it has two sides. It has a totally physical nuts and bolts side, where they break the things, break tree branches when they land, they burn the ground, change the constitution of the soil and so forth. They take physical samples, which sometimes are painful to look upon, flesh from people, and seem to have a totally physical sense of, you know, putting people in the wrong places, making mistakes, etc. So it has a totally physical side. Okay, so the other side, of course, is some kind of totally paranormal side, where they can take a person right through a brick wall. They can seem to be invisible, and so you have, etc. It goes on and on. They can lift cars, airplanes. So there used to be the nuts and bolts people kind of looked down on any kind of paranormal gifts or mental telepathy basic to all of these cases. So they were sort of pissed by the fact that it didn't fit their totally physical look. And of course, from the other side, the paranormal people absolutely hate the fact that these things break the tree branches and then they end up cutting and taking flesh from people, a little not non-life threatening or anything like that. So the thing is so damn complicated, and it has so many facets that people just don't know where to put it. And the extraterrestrial box seems to me to be the one that fits the material better than the other things you mentioned.
Yeah, before I talked to you, I watched a documentary with my son about the UFO phenomenon that was made by the History Channel, I think almost 20 years ago. And they had a whole segment about sleep paralysis and the magnetic fields creating the sense of the intruders. And they had a whole segment where a guy was strapped to some sort of magnetic device and electrodes were on his head. And you've seen this one. And so my son wanted me to ask you, and I wanted to ask, is that possible? Could that be an explanation, just some sort of change in our brain?
The problem, of course, with all these theories is that they have to explain the data. And if the data are completely outside that, you know, the parameters of the theory, then you have to drop the theory. Now, sleep paralysis, of course, is totally ridiculous because you have, although, you know, there may be an overlap in a number of cases where there is sleep paralysis and somebody is too frightened to understand and so on. It's a very rare phenomenon. But in point of view of if there's six people in a car and they're driving and they're all wide awake in the morning and they all have this abduction experience with the physical things that I've described afterwards, what sleep paralysis goes out the window. And of course, you have, you know, it's huge percentage of cases that take place when people are outside walking, driving cars, whatnot, have nothing to do with sleep. And of course, what happens if you got 5 and 6 and 4 and 3 people reporting exactly the same thing? And the thing about the hooking up people and trying to feel that there's some, you know, the idea was there were tectonic plates shifting around down below and the earth inside and creating strange fields. But the point is, why would the fields all be exactly alike and involve physical, you know, people ending up with like 9-inch scars down the back of their leg, you know, after when they were swimming and, you know, walking down the beach and had missing time and they suddenly turn up. And these things are not bleeding, incidentally, when these things turn up overnight after they have these experiences or whatever, there's no blood around. So, but, you know, it's just you have to have the physical side of the data included.
Yeah, this is like the psychic version of swamp gas that they're putting forward here. It's like you're just getting these, you know, magnetic pulses from the earth that create the vision, and it's like swamp gas that way. Do you think there could be something intrinsic to this phenomenon that keeps it at the level of myth? Is it in us, or is it in the phenomenon that makes that ambiguity something that's part of the story?
The UFO occupants, because of their particular gifts, being able to, you know, take a person through a wall or move a car or whatever, naturally seems so out of the realm of physics as we know it that it seems more myth than reality. And I think that there's a lot of control that can be, that they seem to be able to cause in people's behavior. There are limits to that, it would seem, I hope. But so I think that there are just numbers of factors. But I think that just basically humanity just is not ready to accept that there's another out there, another kind of power. There was an extremely impressive article written by two political scientists published in a political science journal, one that refereed very serious thing, and it's going to be reappearing in a slightly re-edited form in a book this summer. But these are two men who were arguing that on Earth, everything, of course, all power is, resides in the hands of the leaders, of the political leaders of the country, of whatever. There's no other source except them of power, really. They point out that in the Middle Ages, of course, there was another source, God, because people could believe that God could overrule the rulers and was in control. But once that idea disappears, it's just down to earthly states. And obviously, the governments of these earthly states are not, it's not possible for them to accept that there is another out there, which is the UFO phenomenon, another intelligence with its own power. And so therefore, I think there's been a tremendous, almost visceral reaction to UFO reports by governments. They don't want to hear about it, and so they ridicule it. And so the ridicule wants to turn it into myth or sci-fi, fantasy, or whatever you want to say, simply because they cannot tolerate the idea that there's another power source, which maybe is greater.
And not just governments, but even just individuals. It's hard to accept this idea that you've lost so much of your power because there's something out there that is random and can intervene any time. On the other hand, though, we live with the constant threat of being dismantled. You know, you could get hit by a bus, you can end up in a terrorist attack, you can have a car accident. We know that our lives aren't really stable.
But this is adding something to those things we already know. Nobody wants that. I mean, one of the strangest things is people will sort of present the UFO phenomenon just in their cockeyed way, whatever they've learned. They'll say, "Well, why do you do this? Why do you want this in your life?" And who the hell wants it in their life? You know, it's in my life because it sort of obtruded itself into my life, not because I wanted it. And I certainly don't like the way it looks.
Saying that, I wanted to ask you a question about my own self here. I want to send you a short story I wrote called Music Lessons, which deals with abduction. And I have two memories that are a little odd. One is that when I was 3 or 4, a man in a gorilla costume stood in my room at the end of my bed, and there was a lot of, not smoke, steam in the room from a humidifier, and I tried to yell for my parents, but a bubble came out of my mouth instead. And that's the only memory I have of that. And see, these are both things that I could just easily just put in the category of dream.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Then the other one is, well, this one's a little harder to put in the category of dream. It just seems like an odd memory. I remember being at summer camp. I would have probably been 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the counselors coming to take us on a hike up into the woods. And we went up, and what they did was they brought us all to this bush where there was a cardboard cutout of a cat with glittery eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I remember. So how do those two memories strike you, Bud?
Well, I mean, they're certainly suggestive. I'll say that.
Yeah.
When I worry with somebody, I want to find out as much as I can about those experiences and also, other things. And it really involves a long conversation.
Sure.
I'm
not really asking to start down that road, but
I understand that. But it's, you see, when you get something like this that's suggestive, that's especially something that's been remembered with a certain degree of vividness. I mean, most of our dreams we have when we're 5 or 6 or whatever disappear. You know, we don't remember them when you're 40 or something. And just the fact that certain things have been held on to means that they have a certain kind of psychic charge that is in itself interesting. You know, I mean, there are many, many people that I've talked to that mention something, and there's no reason to follow them up at all. But I could look at this as pure dream, or something suggestive, something else. So I don't really know.
Music lessons. Psychiatric session, Dr. William Hauser, 11-298. Tell me about the sound. I've given you the wrong impression. It wasn't a sound, it was more of a concept. I heard it inside my head. I didn't really hear it, but I thought it. How old were you? I guess I was about three or four years old. I saw the man in the gorilla costume. He was standing in the doorway. And he made this sound? No. He just stood there looking menacing. There was this gorilla man in the doorway, and there was fog throughout my room. I don't know, maybe I had a cold that the humidifier was on? You were afraid? Yes. I pulled the sheets up over my head. I tried to go back to sleep and then wake up again. You know the trick? It was like, this is a dream, I'll close my eyes, and then when I open them, the gorilla man will be gone. And I can go tell my parents that I had a bad dream. So I pulled the sheet over my head, and I closed my eyes. And when you looked out from under the sheet? He was still there, of course, only now he was in the room with me. And the smoke, the steam from the humidifier, was everywhere. I've been holding my breath, and when I looked up again, and saw him standing at the foot of the bed, I let out a gasp and I tried to scream. Did your parents come to you then? No, I tried to scream, but I couldn't do it. I opened my mouth to scream, but instead of sound, this bubble came out of my mouth. I screamed and screamed, and when there should have been noise, there was only this inflating bubble, and then it popped. It popped. And that's when I heard the noise. Not the screaming noise, but the sound I was telling you about before. The sound you say had such a big influence on your music. The sound that wasn't a sound. It was just an idea, really. It was what you'd hear if you could hear between the notes. Silence? No, something. A sort of deep hum. I got close to it with my tape music. Why did you think of this today? Last week we were talking about your mother's illness, and today you tell me about this sound. How do you think these things relate? I saw him again. Who did you see? The man in the gorilla suit. I saw him when I was in Pittsburgh. I find I'm really comfortable with these little parts of my memory being screen memories, or not like I know what's behind the screen, but knowing that there's something fishy about them and leaving them that way. One of the things I came across when I was researching you before talking to you was a lecture you gave about a UFO case where the primary bit of evidence I saw anyway in that case were some photographs which were red, and which there were no subjects in the photograph. And I thought that was an image that I really liked about that as a kind of a piece of evidence for the UFO phenomenon, were these pictures with nothing in them. And maybe this speaks to my desire to keep them, you know, keep all of this at a distance, but also there's some sort of charge around the idea that there's a mystery to it. So anyway, you want to talk about that case with the empty field?
Yeah, or? Well, that's pretty far out. I'd rather not turn people off. But the implication was that a number of pictures were taken by this family in Australia, where they were with their kids, a man and wife and two kids, and the husband would pose the wife and with the kids and take a picture, and then later move on. She would take a picture. Just typical thing. It was a Sunday or Saturday afternoon in this park by the water. There was a lot of people around. And when the films were developed, to their shock, on this one roll, all the pictures were normal, except there were these four, which were in all in a red range, monochromatic range, supposed to be color film, and they weren't in any of the pictures. They just weren't there, even though the pictures make absolutely no sense. Here's a beach, and water in the background. There's nothing in the picture, but they were standing there, and this was something that extremely bothered them years ago. They didn't put this into any UFO context. See, that's what happens when these things, these oddments come up. I'm sure when you were five, you didn't put anything in the UFO context about the bear.
It was a gorilla. But anyway,
I'm sorry, what?
It was a gorilla, a man in a gorilla costume at the foot of my bed there.
Yeah. But the point is that these people, as I interviewed them in Australia, out came a lot of other things that had happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And what occurs in the abduction phenomenon is that if somebody is taken, they're usually taken as a child, and almost inevitably, it would seem, and then they are re-abducted again and again as if they're kind of an object of study. And so if there's one experience or more experiences, that's the basic rule. I did hypnosis with both the husband and the wife in that case, keeping them separate. Out came exactly the same account of actually this craft, which doesn't appear in the pictures, coming down not too close. The wife, as it were, going straight up. And the husband saying, with the children, of course, she doesn't even look afraid. He is then held, by some force. Again, we don't know how any of this works. He can't move. The camera's up to his face. And when everything is completed in the UFO, down comes the wife and the kids, and he sees them coming down. And then she walks over to him, and he brings the camera down in his arms, and they go home, not knowing anything about what had happened. But they never went back to this beach again. The kids never wanted to go back. It was the closest place where they could swim, but they, for some reason, anyway, it's a long, long story with all kinds of other stuff.
And you interviewed them both, and they both went under hypnotic
regression. Yes, and each remembered the same exact details, the order in which what kid was on the left and which one was on the right, and the pictures, that kind of thing.
Did they both have long histories with these kinds of phenomena?
Yes. The reason they had come to me wasn't about that. They mentioned it because it was still bothering them. I mean, this was some many years later. I think the pictures were maybe 15 years before or something. But anyway, what happened, and they'd always kept them too, because they, even though they weren't in the pictures, but they knew there was something weird. It's like the way a person might remember a grizzly bear at the foot of the bed. I'm not sure. It's just a joke.
It's a gorilla. It was a gorilla, bud.
Gorilla, yeah. But you hang on to these things, which are sort of objectively meaningless and uninteresting things, and not that these pictures were, but you hang on to these things because they're somehow, they're significant, and the mind doesn't want to let them go. But at any rate, what happened with this couple, they had read a book of mine because they had gotten interested somewhat in the subject. And in the book, there was an account, the central woman waking up in the middle of the night. She was she was bleeding from her nostril. This was, you know, 2 a.m. or something. And within seconds, as she's reaching for Kleenex or whatever, her son comes running in, and he's bleeding from the right nostril. And then in a few minutes, his friend who was spending the night comes in. He's bleeding from the right nostril, and so was her husband. They all were in, within like 5 minutes, they're all in the room trying to stop a flow of blood from their right nostrils. This sometimes happens when apparently some kind of implant is put in place. And the reason that this was upsetting to the couple was because the same thing had happened to them with one son. The other son wasn't there. And that had only happened, you know, a matter of months before. And the fact that they all woke up with this bleeding from the same side, and, you know, I would say that's a very good example of Carl Sagan's idea of a mass hallucination.
Oh, God. Right, right.
But anyway, so that's why. But it, but the point is that they didn't show up on these
right.
red pictures.
Did they when you went through regression? Usually, with these people, there are often anyway incidents that happened in childhood. Did they both have childhood?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
See,
yeah.
That's fascinating to me because this is a married couple, right? They didn't grow up together.
No, absolutely. Right?
But somehow they found each other.
Well, that's a whole other. See, you know, we're getting into deep water here because this gets harder for people to accept at every step. I don't want to turn people away from their curiosity, saying, "Oh, this is just too overly much." The thing is here is that I have many cases where people suddenly find themselves tremendously drawn to someone of the opposite sex, in some cases the same sex. And they just know there's something special about that person, and they end up together. And in quite a few cases, this hasn't happened, that they get married, as in the Australian case. But in a number of cases I've had, and this sounds totally off the wall, as it all does, I suppose, they will meet somebody. They're adults at this point and, you know, separately involved with other people. But they meet somebody and they suddenly think, I know her. I remember her. There's something about her. And then they get together and she's looking at him saying, I know you. Where do I know you from? And they go through all the things where they went to school and this and that, and nothing checks out. And he says, you know, I remember what you looked like when you were little. You had pigtails and blah, blah, blah. And she said, I remember you. And then certain details come up that they had little pet names for each other and they knew each other somewhere. And you look under hypnosis, and it turns out they were being abducted together from different families, even from different places. One was at one point in England, and the other was in the United States, just for a temporary visit in England. But they were brought together, and they're sort of observed as little kids how they interact, as if the UFO occupants are trying to learn something about a human, a connection, a friendship, affection, sexual attraction, whatnot. And this, again, goes to the center of the fact that this seems to be such a complex, full-bore investigation or program that the UFO occupants are carrying on.
So is this just about making sure that they get the right offspring here? Are they matching people up?
We can guess at that, but we really don't know. You know, we know what they do, but we don't know how they do it or why they do it exactly.
Right. What do you think about Vali's idea that it's beyond just like a mating program, but that there's a level of just wanting to have social control, or there's a control system?
Well, he talks about the control system, but he never really explains, for instance, if this has been going on for all these years, what the control system is about, or why, or who's doing it. I think that if I may say so, there's a certain sort of paranoid spin that he's putting on this. The whole thing is disturbing enough. You don't have to turn it into something as elaborate as he is doing. He wrote a book about the control system, where it's both sort of human people doing the controlling and some sort of secret government doing the controlling, and at the same time sort of the aliens doing the controlling and so forth. And as I finished the book, I thought, this is perhaps the most woolly-headed thing I've ever read in my life on the UFO subject.
Yeah.
Because there was no logic to it and no consistency. It was just a sort of a tone of a sort of semi sort of tone of paranoia to some extent. I think that Vallée has done some very fine work in straight investigations, but I think his theorizing is leaves a lot to be desired.
Well, I highly recommend that people look at your work, especially the Art, Life, and UFOs memoir, which is a very accessible book. You know, it goes through your life as an artist and as a UFO researcher on a very human level, and it's easy to identify with you as you read the book, and I recommend it. But also your books on the UFO subject are well worth checking out. But it was great talking to you today.
Well, it was my pleasure, because very rarely do I get a chance to talk about some of these aesthetic issues and social issues.
Well, that just about wraps up the 54th episode of the Diet Soap podcast, entitled Just a Gorilla Suit. The music you heard included Chris Istowhite's Let's Build a Sandcastle to the Moon. Now, it's from his album Let's Get Friendly, which is, for all you Isto fans, available on iTunes right now. You also heard Steve Reich's Violin Phase, as performed by Matthew Albert, Nick Nageli, I'm see if I get this right, Yi Yin Jin, and Chi Fan Tai at Concert 13 in June of 2008. That's the piece that served as the floor for my collaged up introduction to the story music lessons. So I'll pause here and mention that Kickstarter campaign again. For the past couple of weeks, I've been offering my short story Noam Chomsky in the Time Box to people who contribute or have contributed to the podcast. But now, if you'd like to help me out with a pledge to the Kickstarter campaign, or if you've already helped me out with a donation or a pledge, and you want to read music lessons instead, or as well as the Noam Chomsky story, well, I'll send that to you as well. So for people listening to this, if you go to dietsoap.podomatic.com, and click on the Kickstarter campaign link and pledge a dollar or so, well, just let me know, and I'll send you the music lesson story if you prefer. Or if you can't do that and you still want to read the story, because I intended to put the whole thing up and then it was too long. So anyway, you can shoot me an email and I'll send that to you. I should also say that the story was originally published in Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, which is a small but reputable zine. And then it was republished in The Best of Lady Churchill's Rosebud Bracelet, and in my collection, Last Week's Apocalypse. So what that really means is that a good library could get that job done for you, and you could find it there as well. It was a pleasure editing together my conversation with Bud Hopkins this week. Right now you're listening to The Blue Danube, but in just a moment, you'll be hearing from my wife Miriam with this week's Titanic Factoid.
A listener contacted us this week about the factoid that I did, I think a couple of weeks ago, in which I read a couple of short articles telling about people who had more or less lost their minds and attempted to kill themselves when they heard the tragic news of the sinking of the Titanic. And he was wondering why I thought that was, that people were so strongly affected by bad news that didn't even directly affect them, and whether or not, you know, this was still happening, and or, you know, what I thought about that. So I gave that some thought, and I came up with an answer to his question. So my thought about that is that, well, first of all, I found those articles in a book that only has writings in it about the Titanic. So if people have lost their minds over other kinds of bad news, it would not have been listed in this book. But I think that that back in 1912 there was no television, and I think people now are somewhat immune to the kinds of violence and bad news. There's so much of it, of course, that you can't even begin to feel very much about it because it's always in front of you, and that was, I think, not as much the case in 1912. But I actually do think that even now people are very strongly affected by bad news. There's all kinds of depression, all kinds of things that people do that don't make sense, that are tragic and violent, that I think are really our responses to living in a world out of balance, even when, you know, it seemingly doesn't affect them directly, as far as they can tell. So I hope that answers your question. So I do have, I had started last week with reading some little bits of primary source material about the Titanic, which I find very interesting, and I found one to share today, short, because I already had some other things to say. So here it is. This was written by C.L. Daughtry, and this was actually in 1970. It may have been an interview, actually, and not a writing. So here you go. When the Titanic sank, I was a small child. My father had been posted to the Olympic, bitterly disappointed because all his friends were to sail on the Titanic. They were all lost in the disaster. On April 14th, a large picture in our home descended to the floor with a crash. In those days, among the wives of seagoing men, this was believed to be an ill omen. My mother's remark was, "My goodness, a ship will go down tomorrow," never thinking of the Titanic, which was considered to be unsinkable. The memory stays in my mind, as does that of the Echo Boys running through the streets at midday calling, "Titanic sunk! Titanic sunk!"